This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Hi all, and welcome to Marxism, Domination, and Freedom Toward a Politics of Socialist Emancipation. My name is Rachel Johnson, and I am an organizer with Chicago DSA. I just want to make a brief announcement about the conference before I introduce our speakers here. So at the Socialism Conference, all participants play a role in keeping one another safe and making sure that folks feel supported and comfortable over the conference weekend. So briefly, I want to introduce our speakers. We have Tom Leidendorf and Mika Yarte. They are both graduate students at Stanford University in the philosophy department. They are also organizers with the Stanford Graduate Workers Union and with DSA San Francisco. So without further ado, I would like to introduce our speakers, and then we'll go directly into question and answer, and I'll explain the format that we'll be using for that. Thanks.
Can you hear me okay?
Thank you, Rachel, and thank you all for coming out. Like Rachel said, I'm Tom. This is Mika. We kind of put something together based on our work. So I'm writing a dissertation mainly about Marxist capital, and Mika works in political theory, mainly on socialist republicanism. And a theme that both of us kind of return to a lot in our work is the theme of freedom and the socialist politics of freedom. And we both think of this as kind of a central political value for socialists and a central category in our analyses of capitalism. This is part of a broader trend in socialist political theory in recent years. You could think of books like Mute Compulsion by Tsui and Mao, or a few years earlier, the book Marx's Inferno by William Clare Roberts. Though, you know, we also are developing our own take on similar themes. If you're not following this, this might sound surprising, especially since the revival of socialism in the United States really centered around a kind of discourse of equality. So you could think here of the Occupy Wall Street movement and the slogan, "We are the 99%," in the framing of the 99% versus the 1%. Or a few years later, you could think of Bernie Sanders using very similar language, talking about, again, the 99%, the 1%, the top 0.1%, something that has been like a real through line in these movements and in the revivalization or the revival of socialism in the United States has been the discourse of material inequality.
Yeah. So our purpose here is not to say that we shouldn't care about material inequality or that we should stop talking about the 99% or anything like that. But we do think that as a sort of guiding value for socialists, we certainly prefer to talk about socialism in terms of freedom, to talk about capitalism in terms of the ways in which it makes us unfree, and to talk about socialism through the ways in which it will make us free. Both of us think that this kind of thinking has been developed in the most interesting ways in the Marxist tradition. So Tom works on Marx's own work. I work mainly on Marxism after Marx. And what really ties the Marxist analysis of capitalist on freedom together, and what ties what we're both going to talk about here together, is the idea that unfreedom under capitalism is not just a function of particular capitalists being particularly cruel or tyrannical, but that there's something about the very structure of a market-based capitalist society that ends up limiting our freedoms in various domains. So Tom is going to talk a little bit about what Marx says in Capital about how capitalist societies limit our freedoms in the economic realm. And then I'm going to jump in and I'm going to say a little bit about Marxist theories of the state and why how they managed to show that these kinds of market-based capitalist societies limit our freedom to self-determine, even in the political sphere, not just in the economic sphere. So I'm going to hand it over to Tom to talk about Marx's Capital.
Thanks. Yeah, so as I mentioned, Mika just mentioned, I'm going to talk about Marx's Capital. It's the main thing I work on, and I'm especially interested in the way the categories, the ideas of freedom and unfreedom figure in Capital. Now, Marx wasn't the only socialist of his time talking about freedom and unfreedom. In fact, this was a really central political value for socialism in the 19th century. And the Social Republic was kind of a common slogan, a kind of a common demand for the left in the 19th century. But Marx is a particularly sophisticated thinker of this period, and indeed his analysis is unique enough that we both think there are real lessons here for socialists today and for socialist political practice today. So I'm going to highlight three main ways of thinking about freedom and unfreedom that Marx develops in Capital, and then I'll conclude by talking about some of the consequences for political practice today. So by way of background, there are three ways of thinking about freedom and unfreedom that crop up again and again in the history of political thought and which are all important for understanding Marx. So the first is liberal freedom, sometimes called negative freedom. This is especially associated and especially developed by English thinkers. So John Locke and Thomas Hobbes are kind of a kickoff point in the 17th century. And from there, yeah, many further thinkers developed this. And you could think of this as freedom from interference. So a lot of the freedoms in the U.S. Bill of Rights are of this kind. So freedom of expression is freedom from state interference in expressing yourself. And another one that is really key for liberals is freedom to contract. And this is something that, you know, basically like represents the marriage of like liberalism and like a commitment to markets. Another kind of freedom that's important here is republican freedom, which especially comes from the Roman tradition of political thought, although lots of thinkers since then have also picked it up. And this is freedom from domination or freedom as political self-rule. And to illustrate what this means and how this is different from liberal ways of thinking about freedom, I'll take an example from Roman political thought. So Romans would talk about, they would use the master-slave relation to illustrate what like domination was and what republican freedom was. And the point here is that if like you're in the social position of slave and like having a master, if you have a master who's, you know, atypically kind or absentee, even if your master didn't interfere with you, if you were liberally or negatively free in that sense, you'd still be unfree because you're still subject to your master's arbitrary will. You still don't politically rule yourself. And it is in that sense that Republicans would say that you're dominated. Lastly, I want to mention freedom as self-mastery, something that is particularly associated with Greek political thought. So Plato and Aristotle both had versions of this. And you could think of this as freedom as self-control or freedom as the rule of reason. The way this pops up in Aristotle, this is what I'll use as an example. So Aristotle, you know, he has this this concept he talks about, often translated as continence. You might think of it as mastery. But what he says is, you know, regardless of like what end you're pursuing, regardless of what you decide for yourself, if your desires are sort of overpowering what you decide for yourself, you're in a condition of like, you're not in a condition of mastery, you're in a condition of weakness of will. And in that sense, you lack a certain kind of freedom as self-control or freedom as self-mastery. Next, just a brief word about Marx's political context. So these different kinds of freedom are already popping up a lot in Marx's political context. So Marx is coming up as a thinker in the time of the revolutions of 1848. These are anti-absolutist revolutions, mostly failed revolutions. And the right wing of this movement kind of embodies these liberal freedoms. So the kind of republic that's created in France is a republic which limits the franchise. And you know, you have a similar thing in the United States, the franchise limited to certain sorts of property holders. Here, like you might have like certain legally guaranteed freedoms, but one thing these liberals want to do is restrict political self-rule to a certain class. And then on the left, broadly construed, both socialists and Republicans were committed to this idea of political self-rule, to an expanded franchise. And like I said, socialists in particular were focused on the slogan of the social republic. Now on to Marx. The first kind of freedom I want to talk about in Marx is freedom from domination in the workplace. So this is a kind of republican freedom. I'll just read a little bit of a quote from Capital. Marx writes that, quote, "In the factory code, the capitalist formulates his autocratic power over his workers like a private legislator and purely as an emanation of his own will." He goes on, but that captures it, comparing capitalists to despots, pointing out that in the workplace there's a certain kind of freedom that you lack. And this is something that is picked up by later political theory, even outside the socialist tradition. So recently, liberals have started to point out this tension between capitalist workplaces and political self-rule or freedom from domination. So there's a book by a liberal, left-liberal political theorist called Elizabeth Anderson called Private Government that makes this analogy. But what's unique in Marx and which sets him apart from both liberals and many socialists is that he connects workplace domination to market relations in general. So Marx wants to point out that the liberal freedom to contract is both connected to and conceals the domination of the capitalist class over the class of workers. And here it can be helpful to kind of contrast Marx with someone who he is trying to provide a response to, which is Adam Smith. So Adam Smith notes that in feudal relations of landlord and serf, or you know, landlord and someone bound to that landlord, you had a kind of personal domination where people are legally bound to certain superiors. And Smith's response to this is that, in market relations, workers are not bound to any particular master. They can choose who to serve. And in this way, he argues that they're in some sense free in the republican sense of ruling themselves. Marx's response to this is that, while workers are indeed free to contract, they're what he calls doubly free in the sense that they're also free of ownership of the means of production. And because of that, they don't have direct access to what they need to live, to their means of subsistence. And so they're sort of indirectly coerced by market relations to serve that class of capitalists. So while workers are juridically free, indirectly they're bound to serve the class of capitalists. They're impersonally, through market relations, bound to enter into those relations of personal servitude. And he has a great quote which captures this. So Marx writes, again in Capital, quote, "The Roman slave was held by chains. The wage laborer is bound to his owner by invisible threads. The appearance of independence is maintained by a constant change in the person of the individual employer and by the legal fiction of a contract." All right, so here I want to move on to the second sort of freedom and unfreedom Marx talks about, which is domination by capital, which is distinct from domination by capitalists, and I'll come back to explaining why that is. So for Marx, capital and wage labor are both social relations, and this already is a point of contrast with some of his contemporaries. So again, sometimes Smith and Ricardo want to use the term capital to refer to any sort of instruments of production. They use this like a trans-historical category. So if you had a tool in the Stone Age, this is capital. If you had a machine in the 19th century, this is capital. Marx instead only wants to use capital to refer to this wage relation. So to a social process where you have someone who is purchasing both means of production and paying a worker a wage in exchange for labor power. And then the worker who is contracted performs work such that they produce a surplus, such that the capitalist is able to realize a profit. And Marx locates capital in this way as something historically specific. So this is different from feudalism. This is different from societies previous to feudalism. There may have been forms of capitalism sort of in the crevices of society, but this was not the general mode of production. It's distinctive in the modern period that capitalism, the employment of wage labor, the realization of surplus value in this certain way is like a prevalent social relation. And Marx says that someone only operates as a capitalist. Here I'm going to quote again from Capital. He says, it's only insofar as the appropriation of ever more wealth in the abstract is the sole driving force behind his operations that he functions as a capitalist. That is, as capital personified and endowed with a consciousness and a will. And he also says that the capitalists are subject to the domination of capital. And he says that they are, quote, just as enslaved by the relationships of capitalism as is his opposite pole, the worker, albeit in a quite different manner. And the way Marx wants to say the capitalists are, quote, enslaved, is that they're subject to competitive pressures and imperatives of accumulation. So they have leeway over workers. They dominate workers in the workplace, but they can't decide to produce just whatever and in just whatever way. If they do just whatever they want, they'll be outcompeted. And that might mean that if a capitalist wants to be humane or produce sustainable goods, that's something they can't pursue in the long run because they have to constantly be thinking about reinvestment. They have to constantly be thinking about revolutionizing the process of production. So here you have another kind of domination, a kind of Republican unfreedom. But here where in the workplace, workers are in sort of a direct personal relation of domination by capitalists, capitalists are dominated by social forms and the forces that underpin them. They're dominated by imperatives of accumulation. They're dominated, as Marx says, by capital. The third form of freedom and unfreedom, the last one I want to talk about, is the lack of mastery over productive life. Sometimes Marx talks about capitalist markets as a force of nature, and he contrasts this with socialism or communism as a state in which people would be able to sort of rationally regulate productive life. And this is really developed in the first chapter of the first volume of Capital. So here, Marx makes this famously sort of abstruse, complex analysis of the commodity form, what a commodity is. And one point he makes in this analysis is that the commodity, you know, the exchangeable good, that's what a commodity is to Marx. The exchangeable good is a way of taking our different private labors, our labors which are not planned in advance, but which we decide to do on our own and bring to the market. It's a way of taking these things we do privately and socializing them. So if I were to start, you know, Marx always talks about coats and linen. If I were to start tailoring coats, you know, just because I perform an hour of labor time, I don't know if that's equal to another tailor's hour of labor time. And if I'm an inefficient producer, I'll find that out in the market, right? And that'll determine whether I can continue to produce. One point Marx makes in this analysis is that there's a kind of unfreedom here, right? We have these private labors that he says we perform concrete labors and then we abstract them in exchange. What happens is you have a complex process of mediation, and that's the only way these labors become social. And so he makes this contrast between capitalism and socialism, where he says in capitalism you have indirect socialization, and as a result, we're treating the market as a force of nature. It's something that is outside of our control, whereas in capital, in communism or socialism, rather, you could have people rationally, autonomously regulating this process together. And Marx does a really great job of illustrating this in this sort of famous quotation from this section of Capital. So he writes, quote, "Let us imagine, or let us finally imagine for a change, an association of free people working with the means of production held in common and expending their many different forms of labor power in full self-awareness as one single social labor force." So the point Marx is making here is that in a socialist society, you would have people participating in democratic planning, regulating productive life in full self-awareness as a single labor force. Whereas in capitalism, what you have is a situation where people are not really intentionally regulating their productive life. What you have is a situation in which we may make these locally constrained decisions very intentionally, but as for the whole process of production, as for the results of our constrained decisions, these are at most only an unintentional byproduct of those decisions, right? In that sense, we fail to master our productive lives. This is something that, you know, Marx's critique of capitalism in terms of freedom and unfreedom gets to the basic structure of capitalism. It's not something that is just a distributional critique. It's not even about exploitation, although he does talk about exploitation. The only way to address these forms of freedom and unfreedom is by changing from a capitalist economy and from a market economy to a democratically planned economy. So I'm going to end my bit there. I'm going to hand it over to Mika, who's going to talk about the way the sort of politics of freedom, the political theory of freedom, has been developed by later Marxists, especially in relation to the state.
Thanks. So Marx, perhaps famously, never really got to say a ton about the state. He was planning a volume of Capital that was going to be all about the state. He died before he even got to start work on it. So we know a little bit about what Marx thought about the state, and we know at the very least that he thought that capitalism was not compatible with a fully democratic state, a state that really realized republican freedom as a kind of political self-rule. But the exact reasons he had for that are a little bit shrouded in mystery. And so the stuff I focus on is Marxist theories of the state, especially of the 60s and 70s, that really try to answer this question, and I think make a lot of really interesting suggestions on this point that are helpful for us even today. So obviously, Marxists aren't the only people who have suggested that there might be something in conflict between capitalism and political democracy. So liberals, especially maybe left liberals, certainly talk about this. And when left liberals talk about capitalism and democracy, usually what they bring up are things like campaign finance or bribery or lobbying. So these are ways in which rich people, many of whom are capitalists, can disproportionately affect the political process by, say, bankrolling a political campaign or directly bribing a politician or lobbying a political party to adopt your preferred view. And as socialists, I think, you know, we should take these things seriously. We should have publicly funded elections, and we should not have bribery or lobbying. But what I think is really distinctive and interesting about Marxist theories of the state, Marxist critiques of the state as of the capitalist state as an unfree mode of organization, is that they go well beyond just the demand for publicly funded elections and an end to lobbying and bribery and things like this. So those things are good, but the Marxist critiques go further than that. What ties a lot of these critiques together is this idea that there's something really kind of structural about a capitalist society that makes it incompatible with democracy, a kind of republican freedom. So a slogan that many Marxists, especially since the 70s, have used is that the state under capitalism is structurally dependent on capital, and that structural dependence skews policy toward the interests of capitalists, sort of systematically, even without, you know, campaign contributions or lobbying, though those things certainly help. Okay, so what does the structural dependence of the state on capital mean? I think the easiest way to explain this is to just give a couple of historical examples. If there are any historians of the French left in the audience, I apologize that I'm going to give a sort of brief and simplistic version of the 1981 crisis in France. You can come scream at me later. So in 1981, François Mitterrand was elected as president. He was the head of the Socialist Party. And quite distinctively, especially in 1981, when the neoliberal turn was well underway, the French Socialist Party had a fairly radical social democratic platform. So Mitterrand's party had promised to nationalize several key industries. They had promised to grant French unions considerably more power on the shop floor, as well as a host of other policies that would redistribute wealth and power in French society. And after Mitterrand was elected, you will not be shocked to find that French capitalists were not particularly happy. They had already lost the election, so it was kind of too late for lobbying or campaign finance or anything like that. And so what did they start doing? They started pulling their capital away from France. So they started selling their stocks in French companies, and instead just either keeping the money for themselves to consume or investing it in other countries. So what economists call this is capital flight. Now, capital flight, as we all probably know, can cause really serious problems for any state. So it will cause huge levels of unemployment very rapidly. That can contribute to uncontrollable levels of inflation, shortage of key goods, all sorts of other bad things. Now, any government that either genuinely cares about the welfare of ordinary people, or even if they don't, just wants to get reelected, will want to prevent this kind of mass capital flight pretty much by any means necessary. Presiding over a recession like this is historically generally been political suicide. And so what does Mitterrand's government do in response to this high level of capital flight? They make a U-turn. So they scrap a lot of their original radical promises, they scrap a lot of the nationalization programs, and within a couple years of their being in power, they have instituted a fairly standard neoliberal package of reforms that includes cuts to public services and privatization of various other sectors of the state. And so in this case, you can clearly see that the sort of private investment decisions of capitalists in the market ends up really profoundly affecting politics. Affecting politics in a direction that is not favored by the majority of people. So here, pretty clearly, a failure of Republican freedom as a kind of self-rule. So that's one example. Just to give another one really briefly, I want one a little bit closer to home. So after the 2008 financial crisis here in the United States, the Obama administration was talking about passing a stimulus package. And kind of shockingly many members of the Obama administration, including a hometown figure, Rahm Emanuel, were pretty openly saying that the stimulus package can't be too big because that would hurt business confidence. And business confidence is often the sort of euphemism that people use to really describe the way in which investors kind of have a stranglehold over the politics of capitalist states. When people talk about business confidence, what they mean is that we need to keep investors happy enough that they keep investing in the economy, they keep putting money into the stock market, they keep putting money into private businesses, they keep putting money into real estate, instead of just keeping that money in their bank accounts or investing it in some other country. And so we all know what happened. The stimulus package was incredibly small. And as a result, ordinary working people in this country suffered a tremendous amount, despite the fact that there was clearly popular support for a larger stimulus. Again, both of these stories, slightly simplified. I'm not a historian. Fred Bloch is a Marxist theorist of the state from the 1970s who wrote an essay I really like called "The Ruling Class Does Not Rule." And he has a quote in that paper that I think really neatly captures the sort of general problem with the structural dependence of the state on capital. I'm just going to read the whole quote. Bloch writes, "Public support for a regime will decline sharply if the regime presides over a serious drop in the level of economic activity. In a capitalist economy, the level of economic activity is largely determined by private investment decisions of capitalists. This means that capitalists, in their collective role as investors, have a veto over state policies, in that their failure to invest to adequate levels can create major political problems for the state managers." And so the idea here is kind of a familiar one, and often one that is actually presented by conservatives. So you can think of the former chairman of General Motors saying in Congress that what's good for General Motors is good for America. Or more broadly, that what's good for big business, what's good for investors, is good for the rest of us. And I think what Bloch really puts his finger on is that, unfortunately, that's kind of true. It doesn't have to be. It's not like a law of nature that that's true. But given how things are organized, all of us do have a vested interest in our local capitalists staying in business and being able to continue turning a profit. And that places certain limits to what we can do politically. Another interesting thing about Bloch's argument is that he uses this language of veto power. And in the Republican tradition, minorities with veto power are sort of these classic villains of freedom as a kind of political self-government. So you can think of constitutional monarchs who can veto policies passed by parliament. You can think of upper houses like houses of lords filled with aristocrats who have veto power over lower houses that are more democratically representative. And so what Bloch is doing here is drawing a kind of parallel between the capitalist class in our society and the constitutional monarch or the House of Lords in previous forms of class society, in that even if we had full control over the political process, which of course we don't, any progress that we actually made in electing people could very easily be undone by the private investment decisions of capitalists, this kind of capitalist veto, or what's sometimes called an investment strike. I think this parallel is really, really generative, this parallel between the constitutional monarch and the capitalist class. But of course, there are differences. I think a really interesting and important difference is that it seems that capitalists don't really have to sort of gather together in a smoke-filled room and plan out how they're going to veto democratically approved policy. Of course, they often do that. But they don't have to. And that's because capitalists act in sort of similar ways simply because they share certain economic incentives. So in the case of capital flight, capitalists just have an interest in putting their investments in places where they're going to turn a higher rate of profit, and they don't have to coordinate between each other, even though they sometimes do, in order to all make these kinds of decisions at the same time and therefore have a really massive impact on the things that the state can do. And notice that this problem persists even if we had publicly funded elections, even if we had no bribery or lobbying or any of these direct forms of corruption in which rich people and capitalists can affect politics. And maybe even more dramatically, and this goes back to what Tom was talking about related to the imperatives of competition, it seems that these problems would persist even if we somehow prevented capitalists from moving their capital. So imagine that we've somehow managed to stop our local capitalists from moving their capital, either by outlawing it or by convincing them to just not do that. Those capitalists who stayed in a supposed left-wing social democratic country might find that they are falling behind foreign capitalists. And that's because foreign capitalists in countries with, say, lower taxes and lower wages will have higher rates of profit. And with higher rates of profit, they can invest a greater deal of money back into the production process. And they can produce commodities for cheaper, or they can produce commodities that are better from the perspective of consumers. And that might result in the whole capitalist class of this left-wing country becoming uncompetitive with foreign capitalists. And of course, that's something that the state will want to prevent as well, because it can cause all the same problems as capitalists just up and leaving. It can cause unemployment and inflation and all these things. And so even if we somehow manage to get our capitalists to stay still, insofar as we're dependent on continued production in the private sphere, states have an interest to keep their local capitalist classes competitive with foreign capitalists. And that in itself incentivizes states to produce the conditions for a satisfactory level of profit making. And that, again, limits the kinds of politics that we can have. And just to finish off, I want to say that there's a point about strategy here, and there's a point about values here. So the point about strategy is that it's going to be very hard for us to just take state power as it exists right now and just try to pass our program. Because if we do that, it's highly, highly likely that that effort will be interrupted by mass capital flight. Or if not mass capital flight, then at least lots of private businesses in our country suddenly going out of business, and therefore lots of unemployment, lots of inflation, all these sorts of things. And so the strategic point is that even before we take state power, we have to do something to start to disentangle this sort of confluence of interests that all of us have with the interests of the capitalist class. And that can take many forms, including building a larger state sector or just having a world revolution. We can talk about all of that in the discussion, but something clearly has to be done. We can't just take state power and expect things to work out for the best. But returning to the stuff we started with, I think there's also a point about values here, which is that capitalist states are fundamentally incapable of producing the kind of freedom as self-government that Republicans have been talking about for hundreds of years. So we don't really control the state under a capitalist society, because as long as private investors control the welfare of the economy, they have this kind of veto power over whatever it is that the rest of us might want to do. And often this veto power is so effective that it doesn't even need to be stated, right? It's just implicit in all political discussions that if you cross a certain line and you piss off capitalists enough, your political project is dead in the water. Insofar as we live in a society like that, this is not a free society in the Republican sense. And that in itself is a problem with capitalism, even before we get to all the stuff about how capitalist economies tear us down. So I'm just going to turn it over to Tom to conclude, and then I'm excited to discuss all of this with y'all.
So by way of conclusion, I wanted to say just a few words about the timeliness of this presentation and why we want to talk about this topic now. So we both think that as socialists and especially as organizers, trying to build a political movement in the midst of overlapping crises, we need to be clear about the nature of the issue with capitalism so that we can chart a path forward toward a workable socialism. Part of what this framing in terms of freedom does is highlight the continuity between capitalism and older forms of class society, like feudalism, like slave societies, like absolutist monarchies, and so on and so forth. And in taking up this framing, we put ourselves as socialists in a lineage of opposition. So each of these older forms of oppression had movements from below that tried to overthrow them and ultimately did. So feudalism had revolts against landlords and bread riots. Slave societies have had slave revolts and abolitionist movements. Absolutist monarchies had to contend with republican movements. And in all these cases, the like these oppositional movements from below frame the values in terms of freedom, partly because what this does is indicate that the problem with society is structural. So it's not just that slave owners were cruel or that monarchs were dumb, although in many or most cases this was true. The problem is that the social role of monarch existed, or slave owner existed, or landlord existed. In the same way, by framing the problem with capitalism in terms of freedom, we highlight the like essential antagonism that characterizes capitalist society. And we show that the problem isn't just a problem with the kind of capitalism we have or the distributional arrangements of capitalism, right? It's not just that the allocation of resources is off, although that's true. The problem is that we have a class society and we have a society that's structured by markets. So in thinking about a path forward, we need to think about ending class society and structuring a society in a non-market way. So we will leave it there. Thanks for listening, and we're looking forward to your questions.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.